Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin, Senior Vice President of Global Strategic Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are entirely unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin again with you for an hour's worth of informative gossip and hopefully something interesting for you to share with your friends and neighbors. We basically are here every Thursday at 2 p.m., as I'm sure you know, and every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. And there's still some confusion about that, so please be sure to tell your friends. But the time is different on both days. Last October, citing Internal Revenue Service data, the Wall Street Journal reported that the top 1% of Americans earned 21.2% of all income in 2005. That's the highest measure of income inequality since, you guessed it, before the Great Depression. The numbers may be off that peak for 2008, given the carnage on Wall Street and all those investment bankers trying to sell their weekend homes in the Hamptons into a sagging real estate market, but not by much. However you slice it, it's an appalling statistic. It may not carry the same visceral visual punch as a Hooverville, but it sends the same message. The richest Americans are gobbling up the lion's share of the fruits of economic growth, while for everyone else, wages barely keep up with inflation, good jobs become increasingly scarce, and making ends meet gets tougher and tougher. Right-wing economists tell us that allowing the rich to grab such a huge percentage of national wealth rewards the most productive sector of society and encourages them to create even more wealth, which eventually trickles down to all Americans. So who cares if the income inequality chasm has widened to historically unprecedented heights? Poor Americans now are rich compared with poor Americans in the 1920s. They've got their fancy TVs and access to an extraordinary array of cheaper-than-cheap products at the nearest Walmart. Are they starving? No. The big social problem is rampant obesity. So let the good times roll and make those tax cuts permanent. There are some holes in that logic. The average American family carries upward of $8,000 in credit card debt. The personal savings rate has never been lower. Healthcare costs are inconceivable for anyone who doesn't have insurance. And right now, home prices, which represent the largest chunk of net worth for most Americans, are dropping at a rate of 10% a year. Never mind how these statistics make a mockery of the thesis that encouraging the top 1% of Americans to gorge themselves on 20% of the pie breeds prosperity for all. The truly discouraging aspect to all this is that if the current economic woes deepen into a severe recession, or if a systemic shock seriously rattles financial markets, Americans are less equipped to weather the storm than they have been since, well, the Great Depression. Okay, I'm Richard Martin, and you are listening to Richard Martin's Wake Up Call, which comes to you by the kind offices of Progressive Radio Network in New York City, and I am sitting at a desk in Miami, Florida. So, as usual, if you would like to call me, you are more than welcome to do so. I will give you my 800, my toll-free number, my 888 number, and you may call at any time, and you will be received by our engineer, who will ask you to wait for for a suitable break in the proceedings, at which point I will invite you to ask your question. But to do that, you have to pick up the phone and you have to dial the following number. 888-873-4643. I shall repeat. 888-873-4643. And we really, really, really do like to hear from you, ladies and gentlemen. It is the highlight of these proceedings, at least as far as I'm concerned, getting your questions, talking about them, talking about your concerns. So please do not hesitate. Call me and get them off your mind. If you are gun-shy, bashful, whatever it may take for not being able to pick up the phone and call, you may email same questions to me at the following address. So please write all in lowercase, and the email address, which I will receive immediately and then read out over the air on your emails, is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Now, please write that, as I said, in lowercase. Write out the word corporation in full, and we're talking GS as in Global Strategic, which is the name of the company where I work, Global Strategic Investments. Again, I give you the email address. It is rmartin@gscorporation.com. Okay, and finally, if you would like to call me in private and discuss your personal issues with me, I would be glad to talk to you. And for that, you should call me on my direct line, available pretty much any time. And it is as follows. Area code 305-357-5575. Once again, I give you my email, direct phone number. It is 305-357-5575. Okay, any of these means of communication would be gratefully received by me, because I enjoy fielding your questions, and please feel free to call us on the show right now for the next 50 minutes approximately. Give me a call and let me know what you have to say. Okay. Another rather grim aspect of the real estate foreclosure problem that I hadn't thought about, but this certainly is an unfortunate reality for the future, if not already for the present. You remember that I had spoken to you about what happens when people are foreclosed on and the bank takes possession of their homes, and of course the people have to leave, and then of course the homes degenerate, and the mosquitoes congregate around the pool, rodents start arriving and the grass grows, and of course the general tenor of the place, of the particular property foreclosed, brings down the value of everything else around it, and that's bad enough. But now, what you're seeing in recent weeks in some cities that have low property values, where there are dense concentrations of foreclosures, you're seeing lenders who file foreclosure proceedings but don't actually take control of the properties, because the lenders have to maintain them and pay taxes on them. You know, there are now areas in some parts of the country where property values are quite low and there are no large-scale expectations of them going up. They don't know that they will ever recoup those costs. So the lenders actually never retake title to the properties and just allow them to become derelict. Well, if this becomes widespread, we could be looking at a whole new class of urban slums. Very, very serious. Not something that I'm afraid most of us have experienced or would want to experience, but which many of us will unfortunately have to endure. Okay, on a slightly lighter note, though not much, you probably remember about this French trader in the bank Société Générale in Paris. His name was Jérôme Kerviel. And this was a rogue trader who was accused of losing his bank 5 billion euros, in other words, about $7.5 billion, in one of the financial world's biggest scandals. Well, now, of course, he's out of a job, but he's got a new money-making scheme. Namely, he will now sue his former employer for unfair dismissal. So the latest twist to this scandal, which made Kerviel, you know, one of the stars of, you know, French folklore, he has now launched proceedings, court proceedings against Société Générale to contest his sacking for gross misconduct. The 31-year-old operator was released on bail last month after 37 days in prison on charges of breach of trust, fabricating documents, and illegally accessing computers. Well, now he claims that his dismissal was unlawful because the bank has failed to prove he did anything wrong. All right, stay with me here, ladies and gentlemen. I know you're laughing, and I know this is only could happen in France, as they say. Well, Monsieur Kerviel and his lawyers are basing their case on two points. The first is that Monsieur Kerviel's massive gambles on markets were actually in the black when his bosses stepped in. The losses only occurred when Société Générale sought to unwind his gambles. The second relates to a legal technicality. French labor laws force employers to hold face-to-face meetings with employees to outline the case for terminating their work contract. But, as Monsieur Kerviel's lawyers point out, the meeting is impossible because Monsieur Kerviel's bail conditions forbid him from entering into contact with any member of the staff of Société Générale. Well, this is French logic, Cartesian logic, ladies and gentlemen, only to be had in France, only in France. So there you go. The guy might make out handsomely. He could get damages from his bank for having lost them $7.5 billion. What can I tell you? All right. No mail this week, which is unusual, but I hope it shows that all your questions are being adequately answered and that you are all sitting pretty, having sidestepped the horrors that are unfortunately besetting the rest of us. I just wanted to talk about this book by Nassim Nicholas Taleb. I've mentioned it before. It's called The Black Swan. And he also wrote another book called Fooled by Randomness. And this whole issue of Jérôme Kerviel at the French bank reminded me of that. Obviously this is a catastrophic event, the losing of $7.5 billion by one junior trader at a bank. You would think that that kind of catastrophe can strike without warning, and it really wouldn't seem particularly hard to understand. And one just has to wonder why Wall Street never seems to allow for that possibility. And also one wonders why they don't learn from past catastrophes. And there have been a number of them, you know, around the world, not just in the United States. Well, I think the primary blame is probably the business schools because the financial economics establishment, because they actually have a vested interest in promoting models and devaluing common sense. Nassim Nicholas Taleb says that he worked on Wall Street for close to two decades in trading and risk management of derivatives. And he says, and I quote, "I noticed that while portfolio models got worse and worse in tracking reality, their use kept increasing as if nothing was happening. Why? Because in the past 15 years, business schools accelerated their teaching of portfolio theory as a replacement for our experiences. It looks like science, and they have been brainwashing more than 100,000 students a year. there is no way my experiences can be transmitted to the next generation because of these schools. We've had fiascos in finance that they need to neglect because they contradict their models. The problem may also be the Nobel in economics that gave a stamp to these junky theories. Someone needs to make the Nobel Committee account for this, for the damage to society, and I hope to do so. Banks thought they were hedging their bets in the mortgage market. Clearly they were wrong. Would there have been a way to participate in the mortgage bond market in a prudent way? Of course, in a less leveraged manner. But greed pushes bankers to take the maximum amount of hidden risks, those risks that do not show on a regular basis because the models miss it, but end up causing blow-ups. Banking is a very treacherous business because you don't realize it is risky until it's too late. It's like calm waters that deliver huge storms. Well, I thought that was interesting enough. If you haven't read the books, it's worth reading. They're worth reading, and I think you can get one of them. I think we have at home, actually, the Black Swan on CDs. So, you know, it gives you something to listen to as you go to work every day, and can't recommend it highly enough. That's The Black Swan by Nicholas Nassim Taleb. That's T-A-L-E-B. All right. Well, here's something for you that I bet very few people know, and nobody really wants you to know this, but here goes. 75 years ago this month, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt was inaugurated as the 32nd President of the United States. Within days after swearing to uphold the U.S. Constitution through a presidential proclamation, he closed the U.S. Mint to gold. Recall that the mint had been established by the Constitution to protect the people's right to sound money. Roosevelt had been elected on a platform of sound money. Barely in office, he reversed himself. He grabbed the gold of the people, marked up its value, leaving Federal Reserve notes in the hands of the people that were to lose 95% of their value during subsequent years. Federal Reserve notes, by the way, are U.S. dollars, otherwise expressed. Well, these Federal Reserve notes stand poised to lose their remaining value before long. Well, that experience left behind a moral trauma that returns to haunt us 75 years later, even if the establishment, the media, as well as academia, want us to forget the anniversary. Never during those 75 years has the nation faced a graver monetary crisis than it is facing now. The banking system of the country threatens to seize up. The credit system is facing a violent collapse. When the U.S. Mint was closed to gold in March 1933 by Roosevelt, and the country embarked on the sea of managed currency, a very large number of individuals and organizations urged a prompt return to the gold standard, which, believe it or not, included the Federal Reserve Board, the Federal Advisory Council, 37 members of the faculty of Columbia University, and 710 members of the American Economic Association, to mention but a few. The question arises as to what has become of those opposing voices in the intervening years. Well, some were silenced through bribe and blackmail. They were simply corrupted by a political movement which they found inexpedient to expose. The upright individuals among them just died. All knowledge about gold money was systematically purged from university curricula and from institutes of advanced studies, replaced by a claptrap of pseudo-mathematical bunk. Well, in his book, Hellbent for Election, written in 1935 by James Warburg, he quotes from a campaign speech given by Roosevelt in Brooklyn on November the 4th, 1932, as a basis for praising the man who would violate his pledge on a matter as important as the people's monetary standards. and I quote Warburg, on November the 4th, 1932, Mr. Roosevelt made this striking statement. One of the most commonly repeated misrepresentations by Republicans, including the president, has been the claim that the Democratic position with regard to money has not been made sufficiently clear. The president is seeing visions of rubber dollars. This is only a part of his campaign of fear. I am not going to characterize these statements. I merely present the facts. The Democratic platform specifically declares, we advocate a sound currency to be preserved at all hazards. Well, this self-indicting speech was actually omitted from the published papers and addresses of Franklin Delano Roosevelt compiled by Samuel I. Rosenman. Are you surprised? Okay. Well, let's see. Talk a little bit more, in fact, quite a lot more, about Bear Stearns and what happened. It's very instructive, ladies and gentlemen. Actually, I think it's going to be very important for you to get what happened with Bear Stearns when other dominoes fall here. Because when you get the process by which these catastrophes happen, as they did in the case of Bear Stearns, and when you really understand how they morph into bad decisions by the Fed and others, then you can really see how this country is trying to handle a problem which, in essence, is far superior to that which it is equipped to deal with. So when you look at Bear Stearns, and when you realize that with only hours of warning, this company got into massive trouble because of its CDOs and other bad debt underwriting. Ben Bernanke observed that this was unforeseen and represented a threat to the entire system, so it had to be bailed out with taxpayers' money to assume liability for these debts. No worry, because over time, these are all good, and we haven't lost a cent. Who could be sure we won't have this event again if we didn't see it coming in the first place? So the key point is, how can he say this was very unusual and hope it won't happen again if they didn't see it coming? Furthermore, what kind of house of cards are we dealing with when in such a short period of time the collapse of a single entity can jeopardize the entire system such that we have to take a step and save it? It makes no sense at all. Now, you know that Bernanke was in front of Congress this week, and Congressman Casey was asking the difficult questions regarding the collateral that the Fed accepted from Bear Stearns. His first question was whether the Fed itself valued the collateral, to which Bernanke stammered and hemmed and hawed that they relied on BlackRock to value it. Right. Next, Mr. Casey asked what happens if the collateral isn't worth what BlackRock said it would be, to which Bernanke replied that the Fed cannot go back to Bear Stearns and ask for more or other collateral. Then Mr. Casey asked how BlackRock was selected as the investment advisor for the deal, to which Bernanke replied basically, we were in such a hurry to do this before the Asian markets collapsed that BlackRock was the only choice. And besides that, was the New York Fed's choice. Finally, it appears that at least one earthling has a clue. However, Mr. Casey still stopped short of inquiring as to exactly what this collateral is. Well, ladies and gentlemen, if the collateral was so good, then why was any rescue needed in the first place? It seems the argument is that it was so good in the long run that it couldn't be sold all at once. Isn't this some kind of bet on the future? How in the world is the Fed suddenly in the business of making these judgments? I don't think I like this. Does this line of reasoning apply to any company that is forced to liquidate and that faces a fire sale? What about a furniture company that's going out of business? Given enough time, they could sell everything for full price. Can we help them out also? Well, let's have a look at the Fed's response to the credit crisis and Bernanke's advice to Japan, on deflation. The Fed, in conjunction with all the players watching the Fed, distorts the economic picture. I liken this to Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, where observation of a subatomic particle changes the ability to measure it accurately. And I think this is quite fascinating, and it really does apply here. So follow along carefully, ladies and gentlemen. This is what happens in Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. To measure the position and velocity of any particle, you would first shine a light on it, then detect the reflection. On a macroscopic scale, the effect of photons on an object is insignificant. Unfortunately, on subatomic scales, the photons that hit the subatomic particle will cause it to move significantly. So although the position has been measured accurately, the velocity of the particle will have been altered. By learning the position, you have rendered any information you previously had on the velocity useless. In other words, the observer affects the observed. Well, I think that's fascinating. It means that anything you look at automatically, just by the very act of looking at it, changes the item. So you can never actually define what anything really is. It's curious metaphysics, but very fascinating. Well, if you apply that to the Fed, you see that by its very existence, the Fed alters the economic horizon. You know, compounding the problem are all the eyes on the Fed attempting to game the system. The Fed cannot change the primary trend in interest rates. However, the Fed can exaggerate the trend, temporarily slow it, or hold the trend for an unreasonably long period of time after the market, without Fed distractions, would have acted. This leads to various distortions, primarily in the direction of the existing trend. A good example of this is the 1% Fed funds rate in 2003-2004. It is highly doubtful the market on its own accord would have reduced interest rates to 1% or held them there for long if it did. What happened in 2002-2004 was an observer-participant feedback loop that continued even after the recession had ended. The Fed held rates too low, too long. This spawned the biggest housing bubble in history. The Greenspan Fed compounded the problem by endorsing derivatives and adjustable rate mortgages at the worst possible moment. In a free market, it would be highly unlikely to get a yield curve that is as steep as the one in 2003 or as steep as it was just weeks ago, when short-term treasuries traded down to 0.21%. In other words, we wouldn't be in this mess without the Fed, or if we were, the mess would at least be smaller than the one we're in right now. Would the market on its own accord be setting rates at the current Fed funds rate of 2.25? It's possible, but there's no way to tell. It's even possible the Fed is behind the curve by not acting fast enough. This, of course, is all guesswork. I don't know, you don't know, and the Fed doesn't know what to do. This is part of the Fed uncertainty principle and a key reason why the Fed should be abolished. After all, how can you give such power to a group of fools that have clearly proven they have no idea what they're doing? The Fed has so distorted the economic picture by its very existence that it is fatally flawed logic to suggest the Fed is simply following the market, therefore the market is to blame. There wouldn't be a Fed in a free market, and by implication there would be no observer-participant feedback loop. You know, Bernanke is passing the buck. If housing continues to collapse, Bernanke will attempt to blame Congress rather than point the finger at the number one culprit in this mess, the Fed, for micromanaging interest rates and blowing bigger bubble after bigger bubble. We expect economic activity to strengthen in the second half of the year, in part as a result of stimulative monetary and fiscal policies, he said, testifying before the Joint Economic Committee on Capitol Hill. The poor man clearly doesn't understand what is happening, or if he does, he is not telling the truth about it. The Fed has no idea where interest rates should be. Only a free market does. The Fed will be disingenuous about what it knows, nothing of use, and doesn't know, much more than it wants to admit, particularly in times of economic stress. Well, according to America's research group, and I quote, 70% of consumers who have received their 2007 income tax refund are using it to pay off credit cards and bills. The first time in 20 years that figure has topped 50%. Well, Bernanke went further than he had in the past, suggesting that the Fed would remain aggressive and vigilant to prevent a repetition of a collapse like that of Bear Stearns, though he said he saw no problems on the horizon like Bear Stearns. Well, the Fed couldn't see the possibility of a derivatives chain reaction coming until after it started, even though this has been openly discussed in the news media for years. Well, the government or quasi-government body most responsible for creating this mess, the Fed, will attempt now, amazingly, a bigger power grab, purportedly to fix whatever problems it creates. And that's the concept under discussion right now about giving more powers to the Fed over the financial markets in general. You know, the bigger the mess it creates, the more power it will attempt to grab. Over time, this leads to dangerously concentrated power into the hands of those who have already proven they do not know what they are doing. Isn't this great? Mr. Bernanke said he and his colleagues at the Fed didn't know until March the 13th that Bear Stearns faced bankruptcy and that they quickly realized a failure to act would create a global crisis. Well, here's another twist. As I mentioned this before, ladies and gentlemen, it's quite clear that the Fed acted illegally. You know, they learned nothing from the collapse of long-term capital management back in 1998 to have allowed banks like J.P. Morgan take on trillions of dollars worth of derivative positions. It's madness, ladies and gentlemen. It is pure lunacy. And it's going to end very, very badly. You know, going back to this question of the legality of what the Federal Reserve did, you know, they decided last week to overstep its legal boundaries, going beyond providing liquidity to the banking system and attempting to ensure the solvency of a non-bank entity. Specifically, the Fed agreed to provide a $30 billion non-recourse loan to J.P. Morgan, secured only by the worst tranche of Bear Stearns' mortgage debt. But the bank, J.P. Morgan, was in no financial trouble. Instead, it was effectively offering a subsidy by the Fed at public expense. The Fed did not act to save a bank, but to enrich one. Congress has the power to appropriate resources for such a deal by the representative will of the people. The Fed does not, even under Depression-era banking laws. The so-called loan falls outside of Section 13-3 of the Federal Reserve Act because it is not, in fact, a loan to either Bear Stearns or J.P. Morgan. Bear Stearns is no longer a business entity under this agreement. And if the fiction that this is a loan to J.P. Morgan was true, J.P. Morgan would be obligated to pay it back, period. The only point at which the value of the so-called collateral would become an issue would be in the event that J.P. Morgan itself was to fail. No, this is not a loan. It is a put option granted by the Fed to J.P. Morgan on a basket of toxic securities. And it is not legal. Not only was the action illegal, the vote itself was illegal. The Fed needs 5 members to vote on such actions, and only 4 members were present. Fed Governor Mishkin was missing in action. The Fed simply doesn't care whether its actions are illegal or not. The Fed is operating under the principle that it's easier to get forgiveness than permission. And forgiveness is just another means to the desired power grab it is seeking. Unreal. Well, you know, I guess this is what we are going to have to deal with in the next few years, as every aspect of our lives, and somebody has to restrain you here, because I don't want to get into politics, but it really does seem that the police state is infiltrating our very existence in every domain. I have just described to you the way in which this is being done in the financial arena. As we've seen, it is being done in more and more aspects of our lives, ladies and gentlemen. And somebody needs to put a stop to it. Okay, we have an email from Tina. And this is Tina speaking. And she says, "Hello, Richard. I know you've spoken about this many times, but I need you to clarify. I opened a new account in a bank the other day and was very clear that I wanted a treasury money market only. The salesperson basically told me that all money markets at the bank are backed up to $100,000 per person. I kept insisting, but to no avail. What do you think? Thanks." The salesperson's wrong, I hate to say it, but your cash is what is backed up to $100,000. As soon as you take on an investment, it may be that the bank has its own insurance, but you know, Tina, we're not dealing with the bank's insurance risk here. We're dealing with your risk, and your risk is not satisfactorily met by invoking the insurance of the bank. The only insurance you are interested in is federal government insurance. And that is made possible by FDIC, up to $100,000 per person in cash. Investments are not covered. Now, it may well be that if you are in a bank, that they will not have a treasury money market only fund, because banks are not set up as investment houses, although lots of them have contacts and agreements with investment houses and brokers and financial advisors of one sort or another. Your best bet, Tina, if you have less than $100,000, is to buy one of their CDs. Right now, you'll get more interest than you'll get on a treasury bill, and all CDs are FDIC insured, which yours will be, are covered up to $100,000. So I believe that's what you should do. When I mentioned treasury money markets, I was talking about investment houses or investments, either with brokers or in 401k plans. And I must now tell you that I'm having problems with this, with several people who are, as expected, letting me know that they've been given the cold shoulder by their investment advisor people. That are basically saying, you know, sorry, but we don't have any treasury market funds. And my answer to that is, well, go and get one. And they can do it, and they will do it, in my opinion, if you follow the instructions that I gave you back, I think, on February the 11th. You can go back to the archives and listen there. I dictated a letter that you should write to your 401k provider, having called him by phone and referencing that call and explaining, you know, that you want to have on your menu of choices an investment which is virtually risk-free. And in 99% of all money market, of 401k plans, there is no such investment. And this is a time where I believe you should be looking at such an investment, and I think you're entitled to it. So, Tina, thank you for your question. As always, an excellent question, subject to discuss. Online, we have Daryl from the Bronx. Hello, Daryl. Nice to hear from you again. How are you doing?
Richard, you always enlighten. If I can say anything else, that is the most important part.
Well, thank you so much.
Were you able to see the interview with Pete Peterson on... well, public station. It was with Charlie Rose. I know that you don't particularly care for Charlie Rose, but the interview was interesting. I might suggest that you want to take a look at it, and then I'd like to hear your comments on it after you digest his position on what's happening with the markets and where he wants to go as an investment. What do you call them? Investment. They keep changing the term. Investment venture capitalist, I guess, something along that line. He's with Blackstone Group.
Okay. And what's the thrust of his argument now?
Well, his argument is that he's speaking that the Fed action was a little more aggressive than what the venture capitalists want to do, and that taxation is totally out as a means of gaining the money that's needed. The American public needs to save more. That the capital needs to come from someplace. So the what do they call those offshore funds? The funds in which I'm missing the correct term, but they're funded by overseas groups of venture capitalists. Basically, what it is that the world would be very nice if venture capitalists were freer to work their magic in acquiring companies and improving them. The challenge I have with some of that is that how are you going to save if the compensation for your work isn't sufficient for you to live in the society in which you're existing? But once again, I want to get back to your analysis, and I just wanted to know whether you had been exposed to what some of the common, both economists, especially out of the Chicago school, and what your opinion was on what folks are planning for this economy, especially for people who are investment light and would like to be able to be a part in their future.
Well, you know, it's actually very, very hard. And by the way, I just received an instant message from my wife saying that she actually has that interview, so I will be able to, view it. It sounds very interesting, Daryl, and I'll certainly try to get to it in the next few days. The basic problem, Daryl, is that there really isn't an answer. It seems so strange. You know, the human condition really requires us to look for answers to all our problems. You know, if you get stuck in the desert without water and you're alone, you'd better find a solution. Otherwise, you're going to die. And it is up to you actually to seek out that solution. There is no alternative. You know, if you see a plane flying in the sky, you can wave to it and hope it'll come down and pick you up and take you off. But you have to do something. The trouble with a collective economy is that when it goes into a tailspin, there really isn't anything you can do, and there's nothing that you should do. And this is a very, very hard concept to grasp, because when we all like to think of ourselves as humans responsible for our own destiny. We like to think that we're in control. You know, we're not in control of our birth and we're not in control of our death, but we're in control of everything in the middle. But that's not true. There are so many areas of our existence, even way away from the economy, where we are really not in control. But if you go into government and you see the economy spinning, you know, into a downward spiral, the natural impulse is to do something. And, you know, Bill Bonner talks a lot about this, you know, the idea of we must do something. And these people, you know, like Thomas Friedman, who wrote the book called The Earth is Flat. And everything is about doing something. You know, if there's a problem, you can solve it. Go out and solve it, you know. And he sort of sets himself up as the savior of the world, because he can always, you know, find a solution for every problem, no matter how big or small. And the reality is that right now, with what we have, the optimum solution is to just let nature take its course. Let the economy unwind. You cannot throw money at the problem. I keep saying the same thing. Every time the government tries to help out by helping some you know, entrenched local interest that's in trouble. It compounds the problem. It's not possible for example, make life better for people by, you know, giving them a tax rebate of $600 or $1,200 when all they're going to do with the money is pay off, you know, their debts or pay their taxes with it. That's not going to help. The only way it can help is if they spend the money on more gigos, which is going to do them more harm, because actually that's going to compound their debt situation. So it's actually cruel to do that. It really is the concept of the traditional addict being boosted by an enabler. And, of course, the enabler here is the government. But, I mean, tell a government employee that, and, I mean, a guy's going to, you know, won't give you the time of day because he thinks he's doing good. So for all these economists who have their own bright ideas about how to deal with the things, you know, really, take the Depression, the Great Depression of the 1930s, it would all have been over in no time at all if the government hadn't stepped in and just basically prolonged the agony. And there's plenty of material written about this. And, of course, it's all to do with revisionism and how the government did the right thing and Roosevelt with his New Deal and all the rest of it. But actually, when you take away the instincts and the creativity from the human condition, then you really do just get a form of debased survival. I remember before I left England in the 70s, the unions were so powerful that basically the awards that you were got given, the unemployment benefits and the social security benefits and other kinds of benefits that you got if you were unemployed, made it so that you actually had to earn a lot of money in order to make more money at your job than you would have if you were simply unemployed receiving money from the state. Well, I mean, Margaret Thatcher came along and dealt that a blow. And I'm not saying, this is not a view of a right-wing person. This is not, you know, what you might think. This is simple, you know, economics, you know, made easy, economics for dummies, if you like, that you have to allow people to create their own existence. And, of course, there has to be, as, for example, in Scandinavia, a balance between, you know, the needs of, and the powers of the state and the powers of the individual. But, unfortunately, in most cases, it goes too far. The state either overcompensates, or else you get societies, you know, much like this society, for example, where you know, everybody's expected to go it alone, and never mind health insurance, and unemployment runs out after 6 months, and the devil take the hindmost. So I don't know. I'll have to listen to Peter Peterson, Daryl, and see what he has to say. Thanks very much for the call and the advice. Okay. Let me see. We've got about 10 minutes left. Just another little word on, you know, advising you to beware what you read. You know, and I'm thinking of, you know, we're back to our friends, the National Association of Realtors, and I'm sure you're familiar with them. We've talked about them over and over again. You know, one of the themes that we look at, you know, is the spin that these trade groups put out on top of their data releases. You know, some trade associations like the ATA Tonnage Index or the Home Builders Index simply put out the straight dope, which is, you know, just an unvarnished, unblinking look at their industries so their members can make better informed business decisions with the available data. Well, other groups massage the data. You know, they spin the message and they try to present their info in the most positive light, regardless of the underlying data. You know, they seem to believe that only the public believes things are okay, it will become a sort of self-fulfilling prophecy. Well, our friends, the National Association of Realtors, falls into this latter category. They have been calling the bottom in housing, you know, ever since the top 2.5 years ago. Their consistent claims of stabilization and price improvements later in the year, as prices have continued to slide, have earned them the title of worst forecasters ever. What is more damning, in my opinion, is that they're not just wrong, but purposefully misleading for commercial purposes. And I think that that is often defined as fraud. Occasionally, they manage to find success, but only when a complacent and or ignorant financial press fails to do its job. You know, we've seen that evidence recently, you know, an embarrassingly incorrect front-page story in the Wall Street Journal entitled "Wave of Foreclosures Drives Prices Lower, Lures Buyers." And in that article, it was a front-page article, the third paragraph, the journal writes, and I quote, "On Monday, new data suggested that pressures like these are starting to drive prices low enough to attract some buyers back into the market. Sales of previously occupied homes jumped 2.9% in February from the month before, the National Association of Realtors said, the first increase since July." End of quote. Well, that was not what the data stated at all. Quote, "Changes from January to February are measuring seasonal differences, not actual improvements in house sales." End of quote. Can you imagine what it would be like if we reported retail sales from December to January this way? And you know the difference between the retail sales in December with Christmas and January when nothing much goes on. You know, headlines would misleadingly state, "Retail sales plummet 65%. Well, that's why with highly seasonal data series, the preferred methodology is to report year-over-year data, not month-to-month variations. And what were those numbers? The year-over-year data for existing home sales were down 23.8% below February 2007 levels. That data point never found its way into the Wall Street Journal article at all. I cannot recall a more blatant misreporting of fact or a larger or more embarrassing error in a front-page Wall Street Journal article, ever. While the National Association of Realtors might be high-fiving each other over their successful deception of the journal, they may wish to reconsider. You know, many realtors in the field are finding that NAR tactics, frustratingly, are counterproductive. Why? It seems that realtors are having a hard time convincing home sellers to price their houses more realistically. Even as home builders were slashing new home prices to move bloated inventories, and I quote, "many home sellers are still holding off, hoping, along with FAR and NAR, that prices will start moving back up soon," end of quote. Hence, the impact of today's successful deception and incompetence on the part of the Wall Street Journal may ultimately be less flexible pricing of homes, negatively impacting sales. I'm afraid that's another Pyrrhic victory for the National Association of Realtors. All right, so we have from Margot Folick, we have a question. And poor Margot says, "I cannot get through on the phone." Sorry about that, Margot. I'm afraid we might have a problem there. Okay, do you think, she continues, "do you think that there might be a plan afoot to create a Fed that has much more powerful controls over the finances and perhaps the politics of the United States? The rules keep changing." Margot, I'm getting a message that we've signed off, although... One second, please. I'm going to call back. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. We had a little snafu there. I'm not quite sure exactly what did happen. But anyway, the answer to Margot's question, maybe I should just read it quickly again. We've got just a few minutes left, if I can find it. This is Margot's question. "Do you think that there might be a plan afoot to create a Fed that has much more powerful controls over the finances and perhaps the politics of the United States? The rules keep changing." Margot Foley. Yes, Margot, unfortunately, I do. It doesn't look as though Ron Paul's idea of abandoning the Fed, disbanding the Fed, is going to work. It's not going to happen. It looks like the opposite is going to happen. The Fed, which has already revealed itself to be probably one of the most incompetent public organizations ever to grace the political spectrum, is now going to be given more powers, and it does look as though it's going to happen. You know, something has to happen. I mean, in some way, manner, shape, or form, there must be more regulation. I mean, it's quite clear that if the likes of Greenspan couldn't take care of the housing bubble and the mortgage problems, then we're going to have a different form of regulatory organization. The problem is that it ought to be Congress that takes care of this problem. It ought not to be a private organization called the Federal Reserve system. It's just, you know, the wrong way around. Why are they doing this? It's clear to me that they protect the interests of the banks and the financial services institutions. That I can understand. You know, that is absolutely obvious. But, the reality is that as long as they leave the system as it is, and people can just go hog wild with all kinds of abuses of the financial system, they're going to go on having these problems. I just don't understand why nobody in Congress has enough spine to stand up and complain and put an end to this. I mean, Ron Paul does his best, but he's a lone voice, and nobody seems to listen to anything he says anyway, so that's not going to work. Unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, and Margot, I'm afraid that it is only when the system has imploded to the point at which people absolutely understand that there needs to be a change, that there will be a change. I don't know when it will happen. I don't know if it will happen, you know, in the near future, but certainly over the next few years, we're going to see a horrendous downdraft, a meltdown of the economy and of the financial world, and I'm afraid that the United States will bring the rest of the world down with it. Many people say we've sort of just decoupled and the rest of the world will go its own merry way. I don't think that's the case at all. I think, like Britain in the 1910s and 20s, that had its own last gasp before losing hegemony to the United States, the United States will have the same. I don't know that it will take the same course. But I have to wonder who is going to be the voice of reason that stands up and says, look, the Federal Reserve is not capable of dealing with this problem. They have a conflict of interest. They have a profit motive. They cannot be responsible for making the laws and regulations that govern our financial lives. I'm afraid that until Congress comes around and until somebody manages to corral them into voting the right way, yes, Margot, the Federal Reserve will be given more powers, and they will mess up even more, and their conflicts of interest will make it harder for them to make sense, you know. And frankly, you know, there's no other solution, and there shouldn't be any other solution. You know, when people make mistakes, they have to take the consequences of those mistakes. And it doesn't matter what endeavor one's talking about, whether it's financial or social or economic or whatever it is. This is what they're supposed to teach children when they're young. You know, if they make mistakes, you don't bail them out. You make them learn from those mistakes. And sometimes it's a hard, you know, learning curve. But that's what's needed here. We need to show the people who made the mistakes, like Bear Stearns, this was a private company that made bad judgments, basically they have to take the consequences. But no, the Federal Reserve illegally hands money to J.P. Morgan in order to get them, to bribe them, basically, to bail out this company. How much longer are they going to do this? How much money do they have to do it with? You know, one wonders. I mean, one doesn't have the confidence that these people, you know, have decent motives and integrity, because they don't. And they've shown it over and over again in their own ways. You know, Greenspan was basically a write-off to start with. I mean, that guy was never going to do what was best for the country. And I'm afraid that Bernanke is just an academic who really doesn't have what it takes to make these decisions in the first place. So, Margot, thanks for your question. As always, a very powerfully incisive question. I wish I had a more optimistic kind of answer for you. But unfortunately, such is not the case. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's been a pleasure, as always, talking to you, and I look forward to talking to you again on Monday at 1 p.m. That's Monday, straight after Gary, 1 p.m. Look forward to it. Have a nice weekend. Speak to you again soon. Bye-bye now.